Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 794. Physicians, heal thyselves, hypocrisy, and the Trump campaign. This is being recorded on March 11th of the year 2016. I think one could certainly say that to date, the presidential primary campaigns, although not inspiring, certainly have not been dull. There has been much made of Bernie Sanders, the self-avowed socialist and leader of something of a children's crusade. And that's not meant to be cynical. He has certainly inspired a lot of young voters, and that is not surprising given the horrible things that young people are facing in this country, thanks, frankly, to the neglect of their elders. There is an old Greek saying, the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children, or perhaps updating that to a non-gender-specific context, the sins of the parents are visited upon the children, and that is most assuredly the case. There has been a great deal of bloviating about the candidacy of Donald Trump, and a lot of people are saying they are shocked that someone who quotes Mussolini was slow to formally disavow the support of overt white supremacists like David Duke, and who has generally come right out front and been explicit about many of the things that the Republican Party has been manifesting for a long time. I think that for Republican, so-called mainstream Republicans, to wring their hands and talk about how terrible it is that Donald Trump could be the presumptive Republican nominee, and it certainly looks like he will be just that, although I guess something could still happen. But even more grotesquely, I think, for the mainstream media that have covered up so much, and we will talk about some of what they have covered up, and beyond that, for the drooling sycophants and wall-eyed, front-running morons of the so-called progressive sector to wring their hands when they, too, have willfully not only ignored what has been going on, but in the case of the Snowdenistas, Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, the Peach Fuzz Fascist, as I have called him, or the Obverse Oswald, and people like Glenn Greenwald, Julian Assange. The Snowdenistas and the Assange holes have embraced exactly the same forces that underlie Donald Trump. When Donald Trump receives support from people who are pro-Confederacy, thought slavery was a good thing, when Donald Trump basically winks at the support coming from David Duke, those are precisely the same forces that underlie Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, and precisely the same forces for which Glenn Greenwald ran interference for years, and precisely the same forces that Julian Assange has embraced as well. So for the so-called progressive sector to go, oh my goodness, this is just awful, I don't know, ew. Well, physicians, heal thyselves. We're going to be taking a look at a lot of things. Now, veteran listeners are going to find much of this program to be reviewed. I think that people should, even veteran listeners, perhaps even especially veteran listeners, should pay close attention to a very important recent book. It has had a fair amount of publicity. I'm going to be excerpting it at considerable length in the program today. That book is called The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. It was authored by David Talbot, T-A-L-B-O-T, published in hardcover by Harper Books. It chronicles the rise of Alan Dulles and the milieu to which he was part and parcel. It talks about Sullivan and Cromwell. It talks about that institution's and the Dulles brothers' involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. It talks at length about the Galen organization, and it also discusses the assassinations of both John and Robert Kennedy, although I personally think that perhaps necessarily the part of the book about the JFK assassination could stand a little improvement. Necessarily, given the scope of the book, it could not have gone into the JFK assassination in the depth really required to do justice to the subject. I think, though, it could have been improved. Nonetheless, that is not damning with faint praise. The book, The Devil's Chessboard, by David Talbot, is very important, and I would recommend that listeners pick up that book and do what basically I recommended they do with the book The Hitler Legacy by Peter Lavenda. Pick up the book, tell people about it, read it, assimilate it, and disseminate the information. Because indeed, what is set forth in The Devil's Chessboard is the institutional processes through which Donald Trump, a man who was very close to Helena von Dahn, the Otto von Bolsching protege, who selected the personnel for the Reagan administration. His attorney was Roy Cohn, who was Joe McCarthy's right-hand man. His pastor was Norman Vincent Peale, who fronted for Edward James Brunley, an Axis spy in World War II. Donald Trump, in short, is part and parcel to everything the Republican Party is, and beyond that, he is inextricably linked to the institutions and individuals who have midwived the hatching of the serpent's egg, referencing the Ingmar Bergman film of the same name. You know things are reaching a critical juncture when the New York Times is publishing op-ed columns warning about the coming of fascism to America. No institution has done more to cover up some of the key events and institutions that have brought us to this sorry juncture than the New York Times. However, the New York Times, the CIA's number one propaganda asset, is America's paper of record. It is worth reading, warts and all, but boy, you need to handicap it. And for the record, 882, The Perfect Sturm, which talks about Donald Trump and the rise of global fascism, I accessed a couple of columns, several op-ed columns, actually four over a period of 2 days, dealing with the rise of fascism in the U.S. and worldwide. And we're going to begin our discussion by excerpting a couple of op-ed columns dealing with the Trump phenomenon and framing that against the background of the rise of fascism in America. The first of those columns is by Timothy Egan, E-G-A-N, from the New York Times of March 4th of 2016. The column, "The Beast Is Us," talking about the people who are shocked, at what Trump is doing, skipping down. Egan writes, "But as much as these too little, too late wake-up calls are appreciated, it's time to place the blame for the elevation of a tyrant as the presumptive Republican presidential nominee where it belongs, with the people. Yes, you. Donald Trump's supporters know exactly what he stands for. Hatred of immigrants, racial superiority, a sneering disregard of the basic civility that binds a society. Educated and poorly educated alike, men and women, they know what they're getting from him," skipping down. But Trump's voters were not surprised at his hesitancy to disavow the hearty approval of a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, a.k.a. David Duke. They certainly weren't shocked when neo-Nazis hailed Trump as a savior months ago, so a little added backing from hooded haters was not going to throw them. They aren't upset that he's attacked one of the foundations of an open society, free speech, with his recent call to open up, unquote, the libel laws. Nor does it bother them in the least that he wants to apply a religious test for entry into a country whose founders were against any such thing. A majority of his Super Tuesday backers, in fact, support just that. And recent kudos from a pro-slavery radio host will certainly not dampen his legions. That support came from James Edwards, E-D-W-A-R-D-S. For Blacks in America, Edwards has said, slavery is the best thing that ever happened to them, unquote. Yes, Trump cannot choose his allies, but it's certainly no coincidence that the race haters, immigrant bashers, and religious hucksters who've been at the fringe for some time are all in for Donald Trump. With media complicity, amen, says Dave Emery, Trump has unleashed the beast that has long resided not far from the American hearth, from those who started a civil war to preserve the right to enslave a fellow human, to the know-nothing mobs who burned Irish Catholic churches out of fear of immigrants. When high school kids waved a picture of Trump while shouting, "Build a wall!" at students from a heavily Hispanic school during a basketball game in Indiana last week, they were exhaling Trump's sulfurous vapors. They know exactly what he stands for, skipping down. He's saying how the people really feel, one Trump supporter from Massachusetts, Janet Aguilar, told the Times. We're all afraid to say it. They're saying it now. So more than a third of Trump supporters in South Carolina wish the South had won the Civil War, and 70% think the Confederate flag should be flying over the state capitol. And 32% believe internment of Japanese American citizens was a good thing, something that the sainted Ronald Reagan apologized for. Judge him by his followers who've thrown away the dog whistle. Voting against Donald Trump at this point is really treason to your heritage, said David Duke, the former Klansman. And judge him by those who enabled his rise out of cowardice or opportunism, two words that will follow Chris Christie to his grave. To support Trump is to support a bigot, wrote Stevens, the former Romney strategist. It's really that simple, skipping down. The German magazine Der Spiegel called Trump the world's most dangerous man, unquote. The Germans know a thing or two about the topic. Yes, indeed, as we will see later. I would like to think our better angels will always prevail, but there are also dark episodes when the beast is loose and what stares back at us from the mirror is something ugly and frightful. Now is one of those times. And a couple of days earlier, specifically on February 29th of 2016, the New York Times featured an op-ed column by Richard Cohen, Trump's Il Duce routine. I'm going to read part of this. Europe, the soil on which fascism took root, is watching the rise of Donald Trump with dismay. Contempt for the excesses of America is a European reflex, but when the U.S. seems tempted by a latter-day Mussolini, smugness in London, Paris, and Berlin gives way to alarm. Europe knows that democracies can collapse. It's not just that Trump retweets to his 6 million followers a quote attributed to Mussolini. It is better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep. It's not just that Trump refuses to condemn David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan who has expressed support for him. It's not just that violence is woven into Trump's language as indelibly as the snarl woven into his features, the talk of shooting somebody or punching a protester in the face. the insulting of the disabled, the macho mockery of women, the anti-Muslim and anti-Mexican tirades. It's not just that he could become Silvio Berlusconi with nukes. It's the echoes, now unmistakable, of times when the skies darkened. Europe knows how democracies collapse after lost wars, in times of fear and anger and economic hardship, when the pouting demagogue appears with his pageantry and his promises. America's Weimar-like democratic dysfunction is plain to see. A corrupted polity tends toward collapse. Trump is telling people something is rotten in the state of America. The message resonates because the rot is there. Skipping down.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
This disoriented America just might want Trump, and that possibility should be taken very seriously before it is too late by every believer in American government of the people, by the people, and for the people. The power of the Oval Office and the temperament of a bully make for an explosive combination, especially when he has shown contempt for the press, a taste for violence, a consistent inhumanity, a devouring ego, and an above-the-law swagger. As Europe knows, democracies do die. Often, they are the midwives of their own demise. Once lost, the cost of recovery is high. Indeed, where to start, however, although I agree with the substance and tone of both the Timothy Egan and Richard Cohen columns, I think that from the Republican Party to the mainstream American press, to the Europeans who know a thing or two about how democracies disintegrate, to the woeful, sinful hypocrites of the so-called progressive sector who, just like the mainstream press, have ignored so much of what is going on, and beyond that, who have enthusiastically embraced exactly the same forces as underlie Donald Trump when they trooped like the lemmings that they point of fact are behind Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, the Peach Fuzz Fascist, and Glenn Greenwald, a shiller for killers, and Julian Assange, a man who embodies exactly the same values as Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald. More about that in a minute. But as far as Europe goes, they're shocked. Shocked to learn that there's gambling going on in this establishment. They shouldn't be. One could not exaggerate Europe's turn to fascism. We've spoken about it in so many programs. I've done numerous shows about Eurofascism. And for the record, 882, The Perfect Sturm. We spoke about the Trump candidacy and compared it with the anti-immigrant sentiment that is driving European fascist parties forward at the polls in many, many countries. Yet another example of that from the Christian Science Monitor of March 6th of 2016. In Slovakia, a fascist-led party gained seats. This is by Ben Thompson, reads in part, "The extreme-right People's Party took in 8% of the votes and 14 seats in parliament. Despite the electoral split, Fico said he would work to rebuild a coalition that could take control going forward, possibly with the Slovak National Party, which took in 8.6% of the votes cast. As the party who won the election, we have the obligation to try to build a meaningful and stable government," Fico said per The Guardian. "It will not be easy. I am saying that clearly." And the leader of that party is Mr. Kotleba. I may be mispronouncing that. That's Marian, M-A-R-I-A-N, of the People's Party. Mr. Kotleba, a former leader of a now-banned neo-Nazi party, gained notoriety in 2013 during a successful campaign for regional governor in which he praised the Slovak Nazi collaborationist government during World War II. The Economist describes him as, quote, once fond of wearing uniforms in the 1930s and 1940s fascist style. As discussed in many programs, including 882, The Perfect Storm, anti-immigrant parties are surging in polls all over Europe. Many of them are explicitly fascist in nature. I would note, too, that not just anti-immigrant sentiment, but the very institutions of Germany, of Europe, I should say, Freudian slip, are guilty of exactly the same thing. One of the things that we have spoken about in some of our programs about the Greek financial crisis called the Greek tragedy, we've spoken about the fact that in late 2011, the Troika, meaning the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the European Commission, had put together a provisional government for Greece to administer their austerity program and mandated to the Greek people, the citizens of the cradle of democracy, was that they include the Laos Party as part of that coalition. That does not refer to the country in Southeast Asia, but rather it is an acronym. It is an explicitly fascist Greek party, not to be confused with the Golden Dawn, another of the parties that has arisen in Greece in response to economic hardship, quote, austerity, unquote, as well as to the influx of immigrants from the bloodbath in Syria. The Laos Party is headed by a guy named George Kalatsaferis, who was once quoted speaking to the Israeli ambassador, saying, quote, Jew ambassador, be careful where you tread with these fairy tales of Auschwitz and Dachau, unquote. And another member of that party was Makis Viridis, who was nicknamed by Mark Ames as the Hammer. He was a supporter of the fascist Greek junta that took place in 1967. He then jumped to another political party, and this doctrinaire fascist, who quotes from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, is now the Greek Minister of Health, or was for some time. All over Europe, fascism is surging. And among the fascist political parties is the Sweden Democrats, a misnomer if ever there was one, originally cast as an Odinist and Nordic superiority, ideological Nordic superiority party. This neo-Nazi party has now become anti-immigrant in its primary ideological manifestations. But it is, make no mistake about it, a fascist political party. It is financed by a guy named Carl Lundstrom, who arranged for a Scandinavian speaking tour for the very same David Duke, whom everybody is saying they're shocked, shocked at endorsing Donald Trump and Trump's tardy negation of that endorsement. Carl Lundstrom is also the man who, in addition to arranging a speaking tour for David Duke, as we've looked at in, for the record, 732 and 745, he was the fellow who helped to finance the Pirate Bay website on which WikiLeaks held forth for quite some time. The person who arranged for the for WikiLeaks to hold forth on the Pirate Bay website was Julian Assange's right-hand man, Joran Jermas, a.k.a. Israel Shamir. He is a doctrinaire Holocaust denier who once said, quote, it is the duty of all good Christians and Muslims to deny the Holocaust. Shamir is not only part of a Russian fascist milieu that networks with David Duke, but he is part of the orbit around MOP University in Ukraine, M-A-U-P. That is an explicitly anti-Semitic university. It is the largest private university in Ukraine. One of its board members is Viktor Yushchenko, whose wife, he was the prime minister under the, well, president, I should say, after the so-called Orange Revolution. His wife is a former Ekaterina Chumachenko, who was Ronald Reagan's deputy director of public liaison and a key member of the UCCA, the leading American front group for the OUNB fascists who were allied with Hitler in World War II. One of the faculty members at MOP University, that's a Ukrainian acronym, MAUP, is none other than David Duke. Maybe the friendliest Duke Snowden is a supporter of Ron Paul, to whose 2012 campaign he contributed money. Ron Paul has been networking with David Duke for decades. Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden's first attorney was a guy named Bruce Fine, who was Ron Paul's 2012 campaign's chief legal counsel. Bruce Fine is also the attorney for the Snowden family. The Ron Paul candidacy is inextricably linked with the neo-Confederate movement. The fellow who arranged for Bruce Fine to network with the Snowden family was Rand Paul, Ron Paul's son, one of whose top aides is a guy named Jack Hunter, who was Ron Paul's chief blogger for his 2012 campaign. He is a former chairman of the League of the South, that thinks the South was right in the Civil War, thinks the South should secede again, and is pro-slavery. I heard a broadcast done by people associated with the League of the South, and they said that, slavery was the only way that blacks could adjust from tribal to industrial society. That is exactly what we're hearing from the people decried by Timothy Egan. Julian Assange is a big supporter of Ron and Rand Paul, as we looked at in For the Record 756, among others. The Ron Paul candidacy, which is very close to Edward Snowden, is inextricably linked with the neo-Confederate movement, the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and the League of the South. One of Ron Paul's top aides is a guy named Walter Block, who has advanced the ideological tenet of, quote, voluntary slavery, which I have termed the ultimate oxymoron and the ultimate collateralized debt obligation. We've looked at, again, Julian Assange, who was a Palestinian libertarian fellow, his right-hand man, a Holocaust denier, Joran Jermas, arranged for WikiLeaks to hold forth on the Pirate Bay website financed by David Duke associate Carl Lundstrom. Watching the so-called progressive sector flock unquestioningly, after people like Snowden and Assange and Glenn Greenwald is disgusting. And for the record, 754 and 888, we took a look at Glenn Greenwald and his links to the white supremacist movement, his running of interference for the leaderless resistance strategy. He, in turn, is part and parcel to these very same philosophies and institutions. So when the progressive sector goes, oh my God, isn't Donald Trump awful? Well, physicians, heal thyself. Much of this program, as I said, is going to be review for veteran listeners. However, there is a book which has had quite a bit of distribution, and it is on the market, and so it is not that often that I get a chance to promote a book that has so much of the material I have spoken about in it. That book is called The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government, by David Talbot, published in hardcover by Harper in 2015.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
In The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot, there is an accounting of the institutional processes that basically spawned what we are seeing. Because what we are seeing with the Trump candidacy is the explicit expression of things that have been at work for a long time in this country. And when we see the New York Times warning about the rise of fascism in America, it should not come as a surprise to us necessarily. Some of this discussion will be somewhat attenuated. I refer people to the website and to the written description for this program, which will be published later this evening, today being March 11th. Of the relationship between the Dulles brothers and Sullivan and Cromwell and the rise of German industry under Adolf Hitler, we read from the Devil's Chessboard. Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers Wall Street law firm, was at the center of an intricate international network of banks, investment firms, and industrial conglomerates that rebuilt Germany after World War I. Foster, the law firm's top executive, grew skilled at structuring the complex merry-go-round of transactions that funneled massive U.S. investments into German industrial giants like the IG Farben Chemical Conglomerate and Krupp Steel. The profits generated by these investments then flowed to France and Britain in the form of war reparations, and then back to the U.S. to pay off war loans. Foster Dulles became so deeply enmeshed in the lucrative revitalization of Germany that he found it difficult to separate his firm's interests from those of the rising economic and military power even after Hitler consolidated control over the country in the 1930s. Foster continued to represent German cartels like IG Farben as they were integrated into the Nazis' growing war machine, helping the industrial giants secure access to key war materials. Foster refused to shut down the Berlin office of Sullivan and Cromwell, whose attorneys were forced to sign their correspondence, Heil Hitler, until his partners, including Allen, fearful of a public relations disaster, insisted that he do so. When Foster finally gave in at an extremely tense 1935 partners meeting in the firm's lavish offices at 48 Wall Street, he broke down in tears. There's also discussion in The Devil's Chessboard, Allen Dulles, the CIA, and the rise of America's secret government, of how Allen Dulles and Thomas McKittrick of the Bank of International Settlements, another Nazi-connected financial institution, helped to frustrate Operation or Project Safe Haven, the attempt at interdicting the Nazi flight capital program that was directed by Martin Bormann and which led directly to the institutionalization of the Bormann Capital Network. Dulles and BIS's Thomas McKittrick continued to work closely together for the rest of the war. In the final months of the conflict, the two men collaborated against a Roosevelt operation called Project Safe Haven that sought to track down and confiscate Nazi assets that were stashed in neutral countries. Administration officials feared that by hiding their ill-gotten wealth, members of the German elite planned to bide their time after the war and would then try to regain power. Morgenthau's Treasury Department team, which spearheaded Project Safe Haven, reached out to the OSS and BIS for assistance, but Dulles and McKittrick were more inclined to protect their clients' interests. Moreover, like many in the upper echelons of U.S. finance and national security, Dulles believed that a good number of these powerful German figures should indeed be returned to power, to ensure that Germany would be a strong bulwark against the Soviet Union. And during the Cold War, he would be more intent on using Nazi loot to finance covert anti-Soviet operations than on returning it to the families of Hitler's victims. Dulles realized that none of his arguments against Project Safe Haven would be well received by Morgenthau. So he resorted to time-honored methods of bureaucratic stalling and sabotage to help sink the operation, explaining in a December 1944 memo to his OSS superiors that his Bern office lacked, quote, adequate personnel to do an effective job in this field and still meet other demands, unquote. While Allen Dulles was using his OSS post in Switzerland to protect the interests of Sullivan and Cromwell's German clients, His brother was doing the same in New York. By playing an intricate corporate shell game, Foster was able to hide the U.S. assets of major German cartels like IG Farben and Merck KGaA, the chemical and pharmaceutical giant, and protect these subsidiaries from being confiscated by the federal government as alien property. Some of Foster's legal origami allowed the Nazi regime to create bottlenecks in the production of essential war materials, such as diesel fuel injection motors that the U.S. military needed for trucks, submarines, and airplanes. By the end of the war, many of Foster's clients were under investigation by the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, and Foster himself was under scrutiny for collaboration with the enemy. But Foster's brother was guarding his back. From his frontline position in Europe with the OSS, parenthetically, that's the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence agency and the predecessor of the CIA, Allen was well-placed to destroy incriminating evidence and to block any investigations that threatened the two brothers and their law firms. Shredding of captured Nazi records was the favorite tactic of Dulles and his associates, who stayed behind to help run the occupation of post-war Germany, observed Nazi hunter John Loftus, who pored through numerous war documents related to the Dulles brothers when he served as a U.S. prosecutor in the Justice Department under Jimmy Carter. If their powerful enemy in the White House had survived the war, the Dulles brothers would likely have faced serious criminal charges for their wartime activities. Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, who as a young man served with Allen in the OSS, later declared that both Dulleses were guilty of treason. I would note, as we have seen in For the Record 278, in particular For the Record 370 and 435, one of the interests that was protected by the Dulles brothers were the Thyssen industrial interests, which were a primary element of the Bormann Group, and the primary American contacts and partners of the Thyssen organization were the Bush family. That was George Herbert Walker and his son-in-law, Prescott Bush Sr. And it appears that the Dulleses and their related interests were actively covering up the complicity of the Bush Union Bank with the Thyssens. We looked at that at great length in For the Record 370. And again in 278 and 435, which, and as well as 332, we took a look at the Bush family's links with the Bormann Capital Network and with the Thyssen Industrial Combines. I would note that in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, available for download for free on the in the books section of the SpitfireList.com website, there is an interesting note about Martin Bormann and Fritz Thyssen. Also, on page 254, we read, also, Bormann felt Fritz Thyssen was his ace in the hole if he ever needed a pipeline to Allen W. Dulles. And we're going to transition into the relationship between Allen Dulles and the Reinhardt-Gehlen spy outfit, about which we have spoken so many times. Bear in mind that Martin Bormann was the head of the NSDAP in exile, that ultimately Gehlen reported to Martin Bormann and his security apparatus. As we have noted in other programs, including AFA 35, and as we have seen in an excellent essay that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt by Carl Oglesby, from Covert Action Information Bulletin Number 35 in the fall of 1990, we note that Gehlen was basically clearing his actions with the Americans, with not only Admiral Karl Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler as head of the NSDAP in Germany, but also with his former chief of staff, Franz Halder. From The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt by Carl Oglesby, Gehlen met with Admiral Karl Dönitz, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Gehlen and the admiral were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Galen sought and received approval from Dönitz, too. In the footnote, as Galen was about to leave for the U.S., he left a message for Gerhard Bonn, B-A-U-N, and another of his top aides, Gerhard Wessel, W-E-S-S-E-L. Quote, I am to tell you from Galen that he has discussed with Hitler's successor, Admiral Karl Dönitz, and Galen's superior and chief of staff, General Franz Halder, the question of continuing his work with the Americans. Both were in agreement, unquote. In other words, Oglesby says, the German chain of command was still in effect, and it approved of what Galen was doing with the Americans. Now note, in the second of the passages from the Devil's Chessboard that we read, repeating it, during the Cold War, Dulles would be more intent on using Nazi loot to finance anti-Soviet operations than on returning it to the families of Hitler's victims. Invariably, that Nazi loot that Dulles was using was under the control of Martin Bormann and the Bormann Capital Network. And bear in mind that Thiessen was seen by Bormann as a pipeline to Alan Dulles. In Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning writes that, in fact, the CIA did actively collaborate with the Nazi, with the Bormann Capital Network. The German government basically had its own version of the Warren Report around the turn of the century when they allegedly performed DNA tests on the remains that had been planted in Berlin by Martin Bormann and Heinrich Müller. This was a fake corpse, not unlike the fake corpse of Adolf Hitler that was planted. Allegedly, the DNA tests proved that, in fact, those remains were Martin Bormann's. However, the remains were then destroyed, and it is not possible for an objective observer to repeat those tests. It basically is not something that has credibility. However, there are very few more credible sources than bank records. On page 205 of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning writes, the file here is the FBI file on Martin Bormann. The file revealed that Bormann had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941, that he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th of 1967, had written checks on demand accounts in First National Citibank Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all of which cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. Again, bank records are very credible documentation. This was in August of 1967. I would point out that in April and June of the following year, Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were assassinated, undoubtedly with CIA complicity. And one wonders, I suspect, that the funds that were being drawn by Martin Bormann here went toward that effort. It would have made thorough investigation almost impossible had such an investigation been undertaken. Hunkering back to the Thiessen-Bormann-Dulles relationship speculated or discussed by Paul Manning. In the Devil's Chessboard, David Talbot writes that Prescott Bush Sr., deeply involved with the Union Bank and with the Thiessen links to the Bush family, was the key senatorial liaison to Alan Dulles' CIA. Dulles' CIA operated with virtually no congressional oversight. In the Senate, Dulles relied on Wall Street friends like Prescott Bush of Connecticut, the father and grandfather of two future presidents, to protect the CIA's interests. According to CIA veteran Robert Crowley, or Crowley, C-R-O-W-L-E-Y, who rose to become second in command of the CIA's action arm, Bush, quote, was the day-to-day contact man for the CIA. It was very bipartisan and friendly. Dulles felt that he had the Senate just where he wanted them. Then, of Dulles' relationship with Galen, and note the continuity between Galen's work for the Third Reich and the Cold War, turning again to the Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot. The Galen Organization saw the Cold War as the final act of the Reich's interrupted offensive against the Soviet Union. The covert Cold War in the West was, to an unsettling extent, a joint operation between the Dulles regime and that of Reinhard Gehlen. The German spy chief's pathological fear and hatred of Russia, which had its roots in Hitler's Third Reich, meshed smoothly with the Dulles brothers' anti-Soviet absolutism. In fact, the Dulles policy of massive nuclear retaliation bore a disturbing resemblance to the Nazis' exterminationist philosophy. We live, quote, in an age in which war is a paramount activity of man, Gehlen announced in his memoir, which, by the way, was prefaced by Holocaust denier David Irving. Beginning again, we live in an age in which war is a paramount activity of man, Gehlen announced in his memoir, with the total annihilation of the enemy as its primary aim. There, unquote, there could be no more succinct a statement of the fascist ethos. Then talking about contingency plans that Gehlen had to overthrow the German government in the event that a more moderate and Soviet-friendly government were to take power in Germany and manifest a thaw in the Cold War, again from the devil's chessboard. Gehlen was prepared to take drastic action to prevent such a political scenario from unfolding in Bonn, going so far as to overthrow democracy in West Germany if necessary. It is unlikely that Dulles was shocked by Gehlen's proposal to reinstitute fascism in Germany, since CIA officials had long been discussing such authoritarian contingency plans with the Gehlen organization and other right-wing elements in Germany. In 1952, West German police discovered that the CIA was supporting a 2,000-member fascist youth group led by ex-Nazi officers who had their own alarming plans for terminating democracy. Police investigators revealed that the CIA-backed group had compiled a blacklist of people to be liquidated as unreliable in case of a conflict with the Soviet Union. Included on the list were not just West German communists, but leaders of the Social Democratic Party serving in the Bundestag, as well as other left-leaning government officials. There were cries of outrage in the German parliament over the revelations, but the State Department worked strenuously behind the scenes to suppress the story, and similar alarming measures continued to be quietly contemplated throughout the Cold War. These authoritarian plans were part of a sweeping covert strategy developed in the earliest days of the Cold War by U.S. intelligence officials, including Alan Dulles, to counter a possible Soviet invasion of Western Europe by creating a stay-behind network of armed resistors to fight the Red Army. Codenamed Operation Gladio, these secret CIA-funded networks attracted fascist and criminal elements, some of which later played subversive roles in West Germany, France, and Italy, disrupting democratic rule in those countries by staging terrorist acts and plotting coups and assassinations. In the end, Gehlen didn't feel the need to overthrow democracy in Bonn, but his organization did undertake a variety of secret activities over the years that seriously undermined democratic institutions in Germany. Backed by U.S. intelligence, Hitler's former spymaster implemented wide-ranging surveillance of West German officials and citizens, including opening private mail and tapping phones. Gehlen defended the snooping as an internal security measure aimed at ferreting out Soviet and East German spies, but his net grew wider and wider until it was cast across an increasingly broad spectrum of population, including opposition party leaders, labor union officials, journalists, and school teachers. Gehlen even used his spy apparatus to investigate survivors of the Valkyrie plot against Hitler. Gehlen was acting not just on behalf of his U.S. patrons, but his clients in Bonn. Even some CIA officials worried that Gehlen was being improperly used by Hans Globke to gather information on political opponents and fortify the Adenauer administration's power. On one occasion in the 1950s, the savvy Globke paid a visit to Gehlen's Pulak headquarters, poring over the dossiers of various German political figures, and taking that opportunity to remove his own file. Well, what was in his file? Again, from the Devil's Chessboard. And we've spoken about this in many shows, including, for the record, 768, I think it was.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Talking about the Naumann coup, the book, The Old Nazis, The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tetmas has good discussion of Hans Globier. Who was he? From the Devil's Chessboard. High among those former Third Reich officials was Chancellor Adenauer's right-hand man, Hans Globke, who had helped draft the notorious Nuremberg Laws, the racial identification system that served as the basis for the extermination of German Jews. As we have seen in AFA 35 and in the program about the Naumann coup attempt, what the hell does Dave Emery mean by Underground Reich? I believe that was part one. In fact, Germany was being administered by a Führungsring, a mafia-like system of covert control run by the Nazi government in exile in Madrid, Spain, under Franco, and undoubtedly being dictated from Latin America by Martin Bormann, the NSDAP leader in exile. And I would note that ultimately the Cold War, the Dulles, complicity with the Galen organization and the primary position of Sullivan and Cromwell and the Dulles brothers in the Wall Street milieu ultimately gave birth to the Crusade for Freedom. That in turn was a covert operation which not only sponsored guerrilla warfare in Eastern Europe using former Third Reich combatants such as the OUNB, it also spawned a Nazi branch of the Republican Party. Reviewing now from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in 1994 by St. Martin's Press. Frustration over Truman's 1948 election victory over Dewey, which they blamed on the, quote, Jewish vote, unquote, impelled Allen Dulles and his protege Richard Nixon to work toward the realization of the fascist freedom fighter presence in the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organization. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Allen Dulles's confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. Vice President Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language speaking Croatians and other fascist emigre groups had been a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist freedom fighters during the 1950s and the leadership of the Republican Party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for the Democrats. In 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee, displaced fascists, hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis and even members of the SS. They flooded into the country, and Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. As vice president, he even received Eastern European fascists in the White House. And of the key personnel involved with this effort, once again from The Secret War Against the Jews, as a young movie actor in the early 1950s, Reagan was employed as the public spokesperson for an OPC front named the Crusade for Freedom. That's the Office of Policy Coordination run by Frank Wisner. Reagan may not have known it, but 99% of the Crusade's funds came from clandestine accounts, which were then laundered through the Crusade to various organizations such as Radio Liberty, which employed Dulles' fascists. William Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey headed up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the U.S. Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor for Dulles' recruits. And another familiar name sponsored presided over the inclusion of these Nazis as a permanent branch of the Republican Party. It was George H.W. Bush, this again from the Secret War Against the Jews, it was George H.W. Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic emigres a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pazdor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. The groups Pazdor chose as Bush's campaign allies were the emigre fascists whom Dulles had brought to the U.S. So when Reagan came to power, Reagan was the chief spokesperson for the Crusade for Freedom. Many of his key early appointees, such as Caspar Weinberger, Alexander Haig, and George Shultz, had served under Nixon, who oversaw the program for Dulles. William Casey was Ronald Reagan's campaign manager and then headed up his CIA. His vice president was George H.W. Bush, who cemented the Nazis as a permanent wing of the Republican Party. Then Laszlo Pazdor headed up the Liberation Committee of the Free Congress Foundation, which projected them into Eastern Europe. And that has much to do with why we are now backing and actively financing the combatant cadres of Nazis in Ukraine. And the SpitfireList.com website will have a lot of information about that will flesh out your understanding. Now, again, everybody is shocked. Shocked. Let's take a look at the New York Times, who published those two op-ed columns with which I began the program. Once again, from the Devil's Chessboard, talking about who the special New York Times correspondent became as the CIA was orchestrating the overthrow of Patrice Lumumba in what was formerly the Belgian Congo. As the Congo crisis reached its climax, a new correspondent for the New York Times showed up in Leopoldville with a distinctly anti-Lumumba bias. Paul Hoffman, H-O-F-M-A-N-N, was a diminutive, sophisticated Austrian with a colorful past. During the war, he served in Rome as a top aide to the notorious Nazi general Kurt Maltzer, M-A-L-Z-E-R, who was later convicted of the mass murder of Italian partisans. At some point, Hoffman became an informer for the Allies, and after the war, he became closely associated with James Angleton, who, of course, became CIA Director of Counterintelligence. The Angleton family helped place Hoffman in the Rome Bureau of the New York Times, where he continued to be of use to his friends in U.S. intelligence, translating reports from confidential sources inside the Vatican and passing them along to Angleton. Hoffman became one of the Times' leading foreign correspondents, eventually taking over the newspaper's Rome Bureau and parachuting from time to time into international hotspots like the Congo. So again, the New York Times is shocked, shocked to learn that there's gambling going on in this establishment. Well, what the Trump candidacy is for the New York Times and the other institutions, including and especially the Republican Party, your winnings, sir. This concludes, for the record, 794. Physicians, heal thyselves. Hypocrisy over the Trump campaign. This has been recorded on March 11th, 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.